Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, and I'm Jody Sanders.
I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Justice Elizabeth, or Lisa Kerr, from the Second Court of Appeals in Fort Worth. Justice Kerr, thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. For the people who don't know you, can you give us a little bit about your background and kind of what you did before you went on the bench?
Sure. I graduated law school in 1982, went to UT. And then after that, I spent 2 years clerking for a federal judge in Midland, the notorious Lucius Button, who's since passed away. For your listeners who are old enough to remember Judge Button, he was quite a character. Then I had an opportunity to take a job in Fort Worth with Law Snakehard & Gamble in 1984. So I've been in Fort Worth ever since then. The last 10 years of my practice, I was with Friedman, Souter & Cook, which is a boutique litigation firm here in town. And then when there was an opening for the Court of Appeals, it was something that had always been a dream of mine. So I ran for the position in 2016 and was fortunate enough to get through the primary and then a runoff and took the bench on January 1 of 2017.
And you picked an interesting time to come to the court because it was a pretty static group of justices. And then right about the time you got there, your colleagues kind of started retiring and turning over. And now you're one of the highest seniority justices on the court.
Yeah, I try not to take it personally that people started leaving when I got here. But but yes, there has been a lot of turnover. And once Lee Gabriel, of course, is retiring at the end of this year, I will be actually number two in seniority behind our chief, Bonnie Sutterth, which is just truly astounding after such a brief tenure.
Remind us, how many judges sit on your court?
There are seven of us.
Seven. And how are those, like my reference point is the Third Court of Appeals, where we've got six justices. And strangely, the way their election cycles run, four of them are up at one time. Is it kind of like that with the Second Court?
We don't have that big a group up at any given time. No, to be honest with you, I couldn't tell you exactly what the breakdown is, but it's certainly not a majority in any cycle.
It seems like it's maybe two or three at a time.
Yes, I think that's right.
I think that's more normal. The way I understand what happened here was there were seats added to the court and no one wanted to give up any time they had left on their term to make the seats more staggered in terms of election cycles. So, but that what we see here is a lot of turnover like we saw in the last cycle because we have so many seats up. I was just curious whether Fort Worth was affected similarly.
Right. Well, you know, in this part of the state, we didn't see the cyclical types of swings between Democrats and Republicans.
Oh, that's right. There were actually Republicans elected to the court in 2018.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Dabney Basil was elected in 2018 with a Democrat opponent.
Right. One of two statewide or something like that.
Yes. Exactly.
It covers Fort Worth and then it goes north and then it goes out west and has kind of a big swath of counties out to the west of here. So
Yes, we go all the way to Wichita County. It's a very large district geographically. It's, I think, about 10,000 square miles. But obviously, Tarrant County is the largest population center.
You're now in your, I guess, fourth year on the court. What were some things that kind of surprised you or that you haven't expected since you joined and got on the bench?
Well, one of the things that I guess I had more of a thought that there would be the luxury of time to really sit and ponder and think deep thoughts, which we do. But the workload of a court that does not have discretionary jurisdiction is of course very heavy. And so we're like gerbils on a wheel. Some people have likened it to that episode of Lucy and Ethel in the Chocolate Factory. I love Lucy. So that's sort of what it feels like a lot of the time. So as much as I would love for every opinion I write to be some beautifully crafted piece of prose, there's just not enough hours in the day to do that.
Yeah, you also kind of unfortunately took the bench right in the height of the anti-SLAPP craze and right as they changed the permissive appeal statute. And you really are kind of right in the middle of the accelerated appeal bonanza from the legislature.
Right. Yes. That has certainly been the case.
All the while with budgets not being increased and in fact being decreased. So.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's like a perfect storm sometimes, but I mean, it's a great job. I absolutely love what I do.
You practiced, I believe you said, civil litigation with the Friedman Souter firm in Fort Worth. Did you have any criminal law or family law experience, or was that something you had to really adjust to when you got to the court?
That was definitely an adjustment because my entire career was primarily business-related litigation and appellate work. So, yes, I definitely had a learning curve with the family and criminal law aspects of it.
Have you found it kind of adapting to those types of cases as well after being civil pretty much your whole career?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I've gone to, of course, CLE programs, and that helps. And I've got wonderful staff attorneys who know a lot about those areas. And so they have helped educate me. It's been very interesting, especially the criminal aspect, just because I had not really given much thought to criminal law since law school. But just kind of reminding myself of all the constitutional principles involved and that sort of thing has been really, really, I won't say enjoyable, because criminal cases tend to be not the best reporter's records to have to read sometimes, but it's a very engaging area of the law for sure.
Docket-wise, how does the Fort Worth court break down between criminal and civil? Is there a rough estimate?
It's about 50-50. I mean, it varies from year to year, but it's roughly split along those lines.
We had one of our early guests was former Justice Scott Field from here in Austin. And Justice Field has spoken out about one of the things that surprised him more than anything just about taking the bench was this sort of sense of isolation that really isn't on the bill of sale. Has that been your experience too, or what would you have to say in response to that?
It is a very isolating job. You really have to make an effort to get out and about. We do tend to stay up here on the ninth floor of the Tim Curry Justice Center, and we don't see people. People never drop by, unlike being in private practice where you could call up friends and go have lunch, or people would just come up and see you. That just doesn't really happen. There's a much more formal relationship with people in the community, with lawyers in the community now. People do laugh at my jokes more, I think, but I hope that's not because they feel like they have to.
I'm burying a laugh right now. I think I just illustrated your point.
Yeah, right.
You know, given your career as an appellate advocate and a litigation advocate, what have you kind of learned about advocacy since you've taken the bench?
Of course, I knew this from the practitioner's point of view, but it has really been brought home to me how important written advocacy is. We read so much, so many briefs cross our desk, so many motions cross our desk, that if advocates don't take the time and care to make their written product as good as it can be, it's very damaging, and it's easy to lose your credibility with typos or, you know, not citing the record correctly, things like that.
We see a lot of changes with, as Jody pointed out, the increased number of interlocutory appeals that are allowed. Summary judgments, you know, we've said on the show more than once that summary judgments, while they used to be sort of verboten in trial practice, they're not anymore. So you're probably seeing an increase, or the court has seen an increase in summary judgments going up on appeal. I've made the argument to trial lawyers many times that written advocacy issue, it's really more important now in the trial courts than it ever has been. But it's certainly true that you've got to maintain a certain level of written advocacy skill and presentation to do the job well, to present cases to the Court of Appeals.
Yes. But you're absolutely right. It's important at all levels. You know, I think back to the trial practice that I had, and so much of it was dispositive motions and briefs and things like that. So those skills certainly carry through to all levels of practice.
And probably even more so today with so much going on over Zoom in courts. I think trial judges are taking more matters on submission as opposed to, you know, with being able to have only a limited number of hearings. It just seems to me that that's something that can't be overemphasized, the need for written advocacy skill. I heard it said once that lawyers as a group can fairly be classified as professional writers.
Yes, but it's amazing to me how poorly a lot of them do it. I mean, sad to say. But it's true. I mean, there's a real reliance, I think, on the old ways of writing. I think back to when I started as a baby lawyer, and probably we all did this. Some partner tells you, here, file an answer to this lawsuit. And the first thing you do is you pull out an old one to go by. And so then you start off, to the honorable judge of said court, comes now the defendant, blah, blah, blah. And then you end it with, you know, praying that somebody go hence without day. I mean, good grief.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. Well, and for those that don't know, you know, in addition to being an appellate advocate and now a justice on the Court of Appeals, you have a very strong background in legal writing.
Well, I was really fortunate. I credit Brian Garner with really heightening my interest in this. When he was still a practitioner with Carrington Coleman back in the late 80s, before he started Law Pros and began publishing all of his legal writing books, when he was first taking over, sort of moving into that direction, we had worked together on a big case on the same side. And I guess he thought enough of my writing skills that he began to ask me to help him out from time to time on different projects. And that ended up with my being one of the contributing editors to Black Seventh, which was the first edition that he took over as editor. And I learned an awful lot from working with Brian and really developing a love of plain English and understanding, more importantly, how much more persuasive it is. I think lawyers as a whole tend to rely on legalese way too much because we think it makes us sound smart, maybe. But really, you can be so much more persuasive with simple words. I mean, I tell people all the time, why would you say subsequent to when you can say after? You know, but lawyers just can't seem to do anything without we filed a motion instead of moving, or we made an argument instead of argued. So it's much pithier, and you get your point across so much better if you use one word rather than multiple words where possible. Obviously, I mean, you can't avoid terms of art, or there are sometimes when legal jargon is required for context. You don't want to start finding synonyms for a subpoena, deuces tecum, or something like that. But by and large, I think lawyers could really step up their game just by trying to make it simple. I remember hearing once that Professor Wright used to say that the best legal writing should be understandable by your average sixth grader. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
I think you're right about people tending to fall back on the forms and thinking, well, okay, my firm has blessed this.
Yes.
And as a young lawyer, you're like, I don't want to do anything that goes against what the partners have blessed.
Exactly.
But then there's that. But then there's also, it seems to me, and I don't think this is any controversial statement, that some of that's just laziness. You know, it's easier if you start with a form and you don't have to think about the way that the intro is written or the prayer for relief. But truthfully, if you put a little effort into it, as you point out, Judge, you can make it a lot more persuasive for your readers.
That's true. And then you also have, though, the tug of the economics. How much can you really bill your client for changing up a form to make it more readable? You might try to explain to them how it's really better, but they don't want to pay for, you know, an hour or two of your time to do that. So,
right.
You know, as far as your kind of legal writing background and emphasis on plain English, how does that play into the way that you write opinions as maybe opposed to some of the other justices on the court?
Well, I think that we all value plain English. I would say that some of us just have a different style. For example, some of us are perfectly happy with starting a sentence with the word however. It's one of my pet peeves. I always start a sentence with but and not however, but that's just me. But we all do care very much about the craft of opinion writing. And plain English is something, you know, I spent a number of years as an adjunct legal writing instructor here in town at the law school. And gosh, even starting in the mid-90s when it was the unaccredited DFW School of Law before various incarnations and finally now Texas A&M. But I tried to impress upon all my students throughout the years the importance of writing in plain English.
Okay, I'm going to ask a loaded question. Citations in footnotes or text?
Okay, I hope Brian Garner never listens to this because I used to be a footnote all those citations kind of person. Now I don't write that way. And I don't mind citations in text. I really don't. As long as it's not larded up with a whole bunch of string citations with many line parenthetical explanations, then it does get very distracting. And that sort of thing you could probably put into a footnote without losing anything. I kind of like to know as I'm reading the text, unless a lawyer is very skilled. For example, if a lawyer is writing about a certain legal principle and says something like, the Texas Supreme Court has so held and more than once, and then footnotes it, I'm going to know that probably what will be in the footnote is at least two Texas Supreme Court opinions. But if someone mentions a legal principle and just says it has been held, and the footnote contains a, you know, 1970 case from some other court that's never been cited for that proposition again, then I feel a little cheated. So I really do not mind citations in text at all.
Well, the other way of phrasing that is it is well established.
Yes, that's right.
It has long been held.
Clearly.
Right. Those are my favorites.
When you read briefs, do you read them electronically typically, or do you read them on paper?
I am very old fashioned, but I like to think that the science of reading and comprehension is bearing me out on this. I absorb material better on paper. Mm-hmm. I just do. And so, although not all of us do this, I have the briefs printed out to read. I like marking them up that way. I have never really developed the skill set of annotating things electronically, and I'm old enough that I don't really feel like I have to change my ways on that. So I really prefer paper.
A lot of the people that I've heard that criticize footnotes in briefing tend to be people who read it electronically, like on an iPad, because then you're having to scroll up and scroll down and scroll up and scroll down. And I wondered if that impacted your perspective on that.
I know that it does several people up here. In fact, we don't have any current justices who put their own citations in footnotes. Leanne Dofino, who was up here for many years, she would write her opinions that way. But yes, I have heard people say that when you're reading, especially on an iPad, it's very distracting to have to go up and down like that.
Well, what other, I'll challenge you a little bit more, because I understand and appreciate Brian Garner's influence on your writing. I mean, how could he not? He's influenced, you know, thousands of lawyers nationwide. Is there another point on which you and Mr. Garner don't see eye to eye?
Boy, Todd's really throwing you the hardball questions today.
Well, we're hoping, I mean, it's already out there that you disagree with him mostly on citations in footnotes. So if
isn't
he ever
that
listens,
enough?
If
Todd,
he ever,
isn't that really enough?
Oh, I think he'll enjoy it if, you know, surely he can accept some discourse, differing points of view.
Well, I did ask him once what he thought of beginning a sentence with the word to, T-O-O, comma, and he slapped me down on that, but I kind of like it. So that's just a minor sort of thing.
Okay. I won't grill you anymore on the,
yeah,
on the Garnerisms.
You know, on the topic of legal writing, though, what are some things that you wish lawyers did differently or better in briefing, things that you see that you think are maybe some missed opportunities?
Right. There are many, many wonderful brief writers. I do think of the ones that I come away thinking, oh gosh, I wish they had done X, Y, and Z. I think first and foremost is using the table of contents to really lay out your argument, as opposed to just saying statement of facts, summary of argument. You can really use speaking headings very effectively to sort of get the court going your way from the very beginning, because I do look at the table of contents to try to get a flavor of what's really going on. I think another thing that lawyers could do, it's not in the rules, of course, but I used to always do this, and I love when I see lawyers put an introduction at the beginning of their brief. I think that can be very helpful to set the stage for what is to come. And the biggest, I guess, missed opportunity is not taking the time to really pare down the writing. I used to consider it a personal failure if a brief came anywhere close to the word limit. And almost all briefs can be cut down quite significantly. But I was thinking about, I think it was Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher who was first credited, was saying, I apologize that this letter is so long, but I didn't have time to make it shorter. Mm-hmm. It takes time. It really does take time to edit something down, but it's a profitable use of time, especially because, you know, I hearken back to how much we have to read. We love it when lawyers can lay out a cogent argument in as few words as possible. It makes our day.
When you pick up a brief to read it, is there a certain place, do you just start at the beginning and read through, or is there a section you always like to read first to kind of orient yourself before you hop in?
I tend to read them pretty much from start to finish. Sometimes I start with the appellee's brief. Sometimes I'll start with the reply brief if there is one. I rarely pick up the appellant's brief first and read them in the order that they are filed.
As far as reply briefs, you're not the first judge that I've heard say or suggest that reply briefs aren't filed in every case. You know, if I'm the appellant, by golly, I should have something to say in response to what that appellee says. Do you feel like, are there instances in which a reply brief wouldn't be appropriate, or do you think that's a missed opportunity for the appellant?
I think by and large, it's a missed opportunity for an appellant, but I understand, especially in criminal cases, sometimes you don't have the budget for it, you don't have the time for it, whatever the reason. Maybe you were appointed counsel who is filing an appeal to set the stage for something else, like a habeas writ, and you don't really need to file a reply brief because maybe you know you're going to lose and you just want to be able to do something else down the road. So there are certainly times when a reply brief doesn't get you anywhere, but in civil cases, yes. I think even if it's just 3 or 4 pages long to, mm-hmm. to take on the 1 or 2 things that you think the appellee said that were just totally out of bounds or mischaracterized your arguments or something like that is a very good thing to do.
David Keltner's rule, and the one that I've always lived with, you know, since I've worked with him, is help write the opinion for the court. Lay out your reply brief, like what you want the opinion to look like. And then they've got a roadmap in a short, simple form that they can take and turn into an opinion if they really want to. And I've always liked that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Although I'll have to say that we appreciate that approach, certainly in terms of thinking about how to structure an opinion, but obviously don't just sort of take reply briefs wholesale and
oh, sure.
You know, slap our name at the end of them.
No, and I wouldn't expect anybody to.
No. But they are a very good roadmap, or can be when used properly.
What about oral argument? You know, I think as practitioners, we all place a lot of emphasis on oral argument and really want that to be sort of our day in court at the Court of Appeals. Has your perspective changed now that you are sitting on the other side of the bench and watching oral argument?
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
I will say that oral argument is very useful in complicated cases, but if the briefing is good, you know, we don't always grant oral argument, even if one side, or sometimes even if both sides, ask for it. If we think the briefing is good enough that we don't really have any questions, I try to be very sensitive. You know, I'm one of 2 justices currently on the court who did not come from a trial court bench, and so I remember what it's like to bill clients for getting ready for oral argument. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, if I was the appellee, I was really hoping that there wouldn't be oral argument because it costs a lot of money. But in the cases where it's going to help us, then obviously, yes. And I think in those kinds of cases, it's also good for the advocates to have handouts, very, very, very brief handouts that just sort of a bullet point of the highlights or excerpts from the contract that are particularly important, just so that we can have a piece of paper or two in our hands at the bench to refer to while listening to the arguments. And not very many advocates do that, but I think it could be done to good effect more often than it is.
Does it affect you at all if you see an appellant's brief come in and it looks like it's a fairly complex case, but they're not asking for oral argument? I mean, I know as the appellant, from my perspective, if I think the case should be argued, I'm not going to hesitate to ask for it. I think because I want the court's attention on the case. That's, I think, the issue for me is that's the way that I know that the court, that the panel is lasered in on my case is when I have oral argument.
Sure. You know, I'm trying to think of a time where I've seen a complicated case where the appellant didn't ask for oral argument. Nothing is coming to mind, but I think that if that happened, I probably would raise an eyebrow and wonder why they hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Or I suppose you could see a situation where, yes, it may be a complicated case, but if the briefing is done right and the advocates don't think that argument is really going to add anything to the discussion, and as you suggest, money is an issue, that might seem like it would be a situation that would warrant not requesting argument.
Sure. And that's the sort of occasion, I think, where when you have your statement about oral argument, use that as an opportunity to explain why you're not asking for it.
Is there anything you've noticed now that you're sitting kind of watching these oral arguments as the decision maker? Is there anything that you think attorneys could do differently or better that can help the court? Maybe some missed opportunities there?
Well, it usually does not help when advocates start reciting the facts of a case at great length, because we are all familiar with the case by the time it gets to oral argument. That's not necessary at all. So it just eats up time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, lawyers reading from notes or from an outline is not very effective. One of my pet peeves, and it doesn't happen a lot, but it happens enough that it's an annoyance, is when one of us starts to ask a question and the lawyer keeps talking and doesn't immediately stop. That's a little rude, I guess, but because advocates are always told, you know, the judge opens their mouth and you shut up, but some of them just keep talking. Or they'll keep talking and talking after the red light goes on without asking for permission to wrap up a sentence or a thought.
In the second court, do y'all meet and discuss cases before you sit for oral argument, or do you just kind of look at them individually in your own chambers and then meet after?
We confer after. So we will not have discussed a case before argument as a group.
And when you confer at that point, has one of the justices been assigned to write the opinion, I assume?
Yes. Yes. Now that can change, of course. Mm-hmm. But yes, by and large, that's true.
Depending on whether there might be a dissent and whether the swing vote gets flipped to the other side.
Right. That does happen.
I mean, Tarrant County has, and the Metroplex generally, has a very healthy appellate bar. In terms of the quality of oral argument that you see, do you see good oral arguments being delivered by folks that you don't see all the time as appellate advocates, folks that you know to be trial lawyers, for example?
Yes, absolutely. We are blessed with some very talented lawyers in this area generally. Mm-hmm. And so the overall quality is quite good, and sometimes, you know, surprising from people that you might just see once.
Mm-hmm. They've got to take off their trial lawyer hat and come into the Second Court of Appeals with their appellate lawyer hat on, or some semblance of it, drawing back maybe even to the law school moot court days. But that's good to hear, because you always hear about trial lawyers coming in and making jury arguments to appellate courts, and that doesn't tend to go over very well.
No, it does not. I mean, it happens occasionally, but yes, it's not effective.
Those are probably the same people that are starting out with long introductions of the facts of the case.
Probably so. They're the ones who need to hire appellate specialists.
That's right.
Hear, hear.
Right. There's some great appellate specialists in Fort Worth.
There are. There are wonderful ones.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because, and this is probably just because Texas is such a huge state, but obviously won't talk about the facts of this, but I'm personally involved in a family bit of litigation in a different state. And of course, we've hired lawyers, but we're the appellees now in the state's Court of Appeals. And I, of course, wrote the brief, Ghost wrote the brief for our lawyers to save some money because lawyers are expensive. Mm-hmm. But I was trying to find like some CLE papers or some nuts and bolts things and talked to somebody, and they said, we really don't have appellate specialists here. You know, we don't do that sort of thing. So Texas is so fortunate to have such a huge pool of talent when it comes to appellate practitioners.
I've found that to be the case as well. I've been lucky to work in a lot of different states on appeals. And when you reach out and try and find kind of, you know, local counsel that knows the court and knows the appellate rules, it really is hard in some states because there are lawyers that have done appeals, but there's not really any appellate lawyers, so to speak, in a lot of places.
Exactly.
Judge, these are interesting times, to say the least. They were already interesting when COVID-19 started and began running its course. And then we had some even more interesting things develop with the ransomware attack on the appellate court websites. I guess we can split those up and deal with them a little separately. But how has the Second Court been dealing with the challenges, shall we say, of COVID-19 and ransomware?
Right. Well, you know, two very distinct challenges, obviously, but they have overlapped in time, and it's sort of a double whammy there. When the COVID-19 issue first arose. Of course, we made it possible for people to work remotely. Even now, most of our staff attorneys are opting to work remotely, but the justices, we have been coming into work, almost all of us have, every day. So I don't want to drive my husband crazy by being home all the time, so I'm glad to have a place to come, frankly. And we set it up so that we would have at least one clerk on site all the time, even during that. So it would be a rotating schedule. And with our legal assistance, just because we needed people up here to process things. But then when the ransomware attack hit and we lost our internet capacity, you know, obviously couldn't get on Westlaw, couldn't get on Thames. That was just, you know, we were paralyzed for a while, but we've got wonderful leadership here at the court. And so we were able to move fairly quickly into reviving the old system, which of course predated my tenure on the court, of doing everything on paper. So motions get circulated in color-coded file covers like they used to, and we all read them and check off our vote on paper. So it was really kind of a throwback, but we're now back up on Thames and are able to process things electronically now.
I know Thames hasn't been completely fixed. It's mostly fixed, at least
right.
As of the date of the May 8th, I believe it was, yes. Was sort of the freeze date.
Yes. We did lose. I'm not quite sure how much information as of the day it happened, but we've been able to get back a huge amount of it.
Well, I know that's still in process, and OCA and the Supreme Court folks that are dealing with this are doing a great job of trying to bring it back, and it will get brought back in full. I have no doubt. It's just a little ironic, though, that, you know, we've had this wonderful system in place and everyone's just getting really used to working in this electronic environment, even if you like to print your briefs out and mark them up. And the fail-safe, you know, the safety net is, of course, you know, you have to go back to paper.
Right.
But I think that's reassuring, though, because, you know, for the user, it really, for some time, and I'm not speaking specifically about the second court, but it really was difficult from a practitioner standpoint because we couldn't tell what was going on inside the courts, courts of appeals. And so it's nice to hear what the second court did to adjust, and then knowing that you all, the justices, are actually going into the chambers, you know, the work, from what you described, the work could keep flowing in that situation.
Yes. And obviously we were able to email with our staff attorneys and they could get on Westlaw at home. So the work was flowing. I mean, we've all been very proud of the way we've pulled together and have kept things moving along. It would have been very easy to just throw up our hands after all of this and say, well, we're just going to take a month off and we'll come back later. But we've been soldiering on.
Well, that's great to hear.
Any ideas on moving forward when the court's going to go back to oral arguments, whether in person or electronically?
Well, we don't have any plans to do it electronically. We're, I think, old-fashioned enough to recognize the importance of, I think there's just something about being in a room, in the same room with advocates and the justices. You know, you miss a lot on Zoom meetings. They've been great as a stopgap, but I really hope that we don't go to a system where that becomes a routine practice. You know, you just get so much more of a sense of body language and interaction between the judges and all of that when you're in a room as an advocate watching them. And that's really lost. But as far as your question about when we're going to resume in-person arguments, of course, during the summertime, our practice is to take the summer. You know, some people say, oh, you just don't do anything in the summer. But no, we typically stop having, in a normal year, we would quit having oral arguments, early part of June, and then spend the rest of June, July, and August. Our fiscal year ends August 31st. We would spend that time focusing on the cases that are either harder, will be a longer opinion. It gives us time to really sit and crank those sorts of opinions out. So we're hoping that we will start oral arguments back up as we would normally do in September. But we have not yet finalized a plan for that.
Mm-hmm. I feel like just like everything else in the world, there's just a lot of moving parts and uncertainties right now and all that.
That's exactly right. But, you know, Jody, you've been in our courtroom. Todd, I'm sure you have too. It's very easy to spread out.
Sure.
Probably every courtroom. So we could certainly accommodate social distancing without any problems at all.
Yeah. Y'all are set up very well for that. You know, you have a big wide open courtroom with a big wide open bench and
lots
of room between the tables already. It really is kind of already set up for social distancing.
Yes, and a very spread out lobby outside of our office in the courtroom. We have a lot of space.
Has it been kind of weird being in the courthouse with not that much going on downstairs?
We don't really see them downstairs that much. It's only been weird in the sense that we've gotten fewer appeals. I mean, the filings are certainly down. They've definitely been down, but we expect that, well, we don't know. We're anticipating that there might be a pent-up demand and we'll get slammed all at the same time, or it might get spread out. We just can't predict that. But yes, it is weird sometimes going into the parking garage where all the criminal court judges and the Court of Appeal justices park and seeing very, very few cars in there. But gradually it's gotten to where more people are in the building, more judges are in the building. But early on, yes, it was like a ghost town. Mm.
Well, we always like to kind of close out by asking our guests to give a tip or a war story. You've given a lot of great tips. I don't know if you have another one or a war story that you'd like to share with us in closing today.
You know, I hope I've given enough tips here and there. I think it'd probably be maybe redundant to say more about that, but I'll give a war story from about a year ago. I was on a panel with one of my colleagues who's now no longer with us. And to me, this is an example of a case where, you know, not every appeal needs to be brought. Sometimes it's not the best use of clients' time and money. And we had an appeal. It was in a family law case. And the amount of money involved was less than $40 a month that one of the parties had been ordered to pay. And my colleague, I won't name him, but he actually referred to, if y'all remember, the Dondi Properties decision from the Northern District of Texas back in 1988, the one that sort of spurred the lawyer's creed and all this sort of the real focus on being an ethical and responsible advocate. Not that the people involved in this case weren't, but my colleague, I think he started, they might not have even gotten a question in it edgewise before he was like, are we really here? Are you really taking up valuable court time and resources for less than $40 a month? And of course, the appellant's lawyer had to say yes, and it sort of went downhill from there. But yes, the parties were invited to stay afterwards and work it out. They didn't.
Gosh.
And they were also invited to go back and reread Dondi Properties. So that was, I had never seen an oral argument go quite that way. And I'm sure that the appellant wished that they hadn't asked for argument.
Yeah, that's a zinger of a first question to have to start with. And then,
I have never heard of parties being invited to stay and try to work it out after an oral argument.
The Court of Appeals. You see it in the trial court all the time, but not the Court of Appeals.
Right.
Isn't that interesting? Oh my goodness. Wow.
That's probably been the most interesting oral argument that I've been a part of.
Well, Justice Kerr, it's been a pleasure having you with us today.
It has.
We've enjoyed visiting with you, and we appreciate you taking the time to come on. And we look forward to, I'll certainly look forward to appearing in your court. It's been some time for me not living there in Fort Worth, but I know Jody is going to look forward to actually being back in the courtroom to argue at some point in the future soon, we hope.
Right. Well, and we always love visitors. Don't have to be here for oral argument.
Well, thank you for that invitation. And before we go, we'd like to pause for just a moment and thank our sponsors, Court Surety Bond Agency and Thomson Reuters. And we'd like to thank you, our listeners, for giving us your attention for this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
We really appreciate it if you take the time to rate us and review the show on Apple Podcasts. That'd be great. And we appreciate everybody that's rated us so far.
If you have any questions, thoughts, or comments, please reach out to us on Twitter or over email or through the podcast Facebook page. We would love to hear from you.
And until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com. or on Twitter at @TexAppLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.